Okay, so let's get started.
Sorry, I'm just going to tell you what I have to email you, but we'll do that
class. Yes. So, quick announcement about the group if you haven't yet sent, as he was pointing out, me this information, you need to do this soon. Okay. And if you have already sent me your group information, you should have received an email from me saying we have added you to the system. If you haven't received that email, check with me again. Okay.
Is it just
going to
recognize our
Yes. So once I enter you into the system, it should recognize you when you submit. Okay. Has anyone tried submitting a project to the autograder? No one has tried. Okay. So I would recommend that you try it. Even if you send in a blank program, that's okay because you know how it works. You get one submission a day. So if you are not going to submit today, just send in an email to the autograder so you know how it works. Okay, you don't want surprises at the last minute. Okay? Alright, so let us continue where we left off last time. Yes, you have a question here.
Do you need everybody in the group to submit the project three different times or just one person?
Okay, question about whether you should submit. Each individual person should submit, or you should just submit right as a group. So you should just submit once as a group, because the autograder knows about your group and it's going to recognize that the submission is actually coming from all three of you. Okay? And each group gets one submission a day. Not like if you have three people, you cannot submit three times. Okay. You had a question there? Okay. Alright, so just to continue where we left off last time, we were talking about OS, the structure of operating system kernel. I talked about the monolithic architecture, which is basically one large blob of code, and any function in the kernel can call any other function. Okay? Advantages are high efficiency, okay, because any component can talk to any other component via simple system calls. Disadvantage is that the kernel is hard to maintain. Okay? There may be all sorts of dependencies that don't become clear until some modification is made and something else breaks. So it's hard to maintain and debug. So the two more modular architectures we talked about are the layered design and the microkernel design. Okay, and I talked about what the microkernel is. It's a very small, compact kernel that provides bare bones functionality, namely inter-process communication. Okay. Now, let me talk about one more architecture, which is a kernel based on kernel module. Okay. Now, most current kernels today actually look something like this. Okay. So, what does think of this as more of an object-oriented way of designing the operating system kernel? Okay. The kernel consists of a number of modules. Each module, okay, implements a certain functionality, and there is a well-known interface to interact with the functionality implemented by that module. Okay? And you only interact with that module through that interface. You do not call any internal function directly, okay, because that breaks the modular architecture. Okay? So there's interfaces that are published by each module that are used to communicate with it. More importantly, okay, modules can be dynamically loaded on an as-needed basis. Okay, there may be lots of modules, but your machine may not need all of them. Okay? So your kernel, when it boots up, actually decides what subset of those modules are necessary for your machine and only loads those modules. Okay, all other modules just stay on disks and are not loaded. Okay? So as opposed to the monolithic kernel where everything has to be loaded, okay, here you can pick and choose. If you have a certain device, and the device driver or modules corresponding to that device are loaded. And if you don't have that, then you don't have to load that. So your kernel becomes smaller in size. The runtime kernel is smaller in size. You only load functionality on demand. Okay? And you get a more object-oriented modular architecture. Okay, so this is similar to the layered framework, but a lot more flexible. Okay, in the layered framework, only each layer could only talk to the layer above it and layer below it. Here, any module can talk to any other module. So there may be module dependency. So there is less restrictions on what component can talk to what other component, which is why it's more flexible. Okay? And that also makes it easier to understand how to sort of write these modules and how to derive these dependencies. Here is just a picture of how Solaris looks like in terms of its modular architecture. So there is a core kernel. Okay, this includes functionality that should always be included, okay, no matter what. So for example, process management, CPU scheduling, they are all part of the core kernel. That's not an optional feature. Modules may be optional, okay, in many cases. So, and there are a whole bunch of these other ones. There are scheduling classes that may implement a new scheduling algorithm. So they could extend the functionality of the core CPU scheduler. Okay, there are numerous file systems the kernel may support, not just one. Linux has support for more than a dozen different file systems. Everything from FAT16 to NTFS to EXT3 and others. Okay. And you may not need to load all of them, but there is support for them, and each file system is a module. And depending on what devices are connected to your machine, only the right subset of those are loaded. Okay. There are loaded, you can extend the system call interface by implementing new loadable system calls, and there are others. Okay. This should just give you a flavor of what the modular architecture looks like. Okay. There's always a core kernel, and the functionality is extended through a set of these modules. Yes, question?
Couldn't you have a monolithic system that exists and you're not really controlling who can contact who, you're just controlling what's loaded in memory?
Right, so the definition of a monolithic system, just one second, is that you always have one blob of code that is always loaded into memory. Okay?
Yeah,
there is nothing, yes.
What was the second part? Was it anything can call anything?
Yes, right. So and then as a result, it's just one program, so any function can call any other function. Here you have optional pieces, so there may be modules that are never loaded, okay, or loaded on demand. So this allows you to extend the functionality of the kernel using this architecture, and each module also exports interface, and you only interact with that module through that interface. You're not supposed to call internal function. In the monolithic kernel, you could then call any piece of code in here. Okay. You had a question there?
Yes. What are the streams modules?
Okay, what are the streams model? There is a streams framework that allows you to do data processing. It's not important as to what.
Is that it like pipes, basically?
Pipes are just one example. There is a generalizes that a little bit.
Okay.
There are a lot more. I mean, this is just actually an old picture. If you look at Solaris 10, it's much more diverse in terms of what it can do. Okay. Is this clear? Okay. So, coming back to what we have discussed in the last lecture. So, what we said is there are some hardware features, okay, that the machine, underlying machine provides us, and the operating system makes use of these features to provide useful services, okay, namely process management, memory management, I/O device management and file system management, as well as networking. And you as a user and or applications, okay, access these services through some abstraction. So, in case of process management, this is the abstraction is the ability to create processes, okay, launch new programs, terminate existing programs as processes and so on. There's the address space abstraction for memory management, and there are I/O devices you interact with and so on. Okay. So, that's the picture to keep in mind. Okay, as I had mentioned, what we will do in the rest of this course is actually take each of these rows and look at that in more detail. Okay? Starting today, we are actually going to look at process management. So we are going to start the first major topic of this course, namely process management. And then we will look at memory management in more detail. This will be the third component, I/O devices and file systems, and distributed systems will be the fourth component of the course. Okay, So this is what we will do today. Okay, I'll talk about what a process is. I briefly alluded to it last time, okay, when I introduced this notion of process management, but we'll define it more carefully. We'll try to understand how the operating system kernel manages processes. Okay, we'll talk about what are the possible execution states of a process and how does a process make transition from one state to another. Okay. And if we have time, I'm going to start the inter-process communication as a subtopic, okay, in the course. Otherwise, if we run out of time, we'll look at that in the next class. Okay, so let's start with what's a process. Okay, I already defined this last time. A process is basically the dynamic execution context of an executing program. A process is different from a program. Program is a piece of code that resides on your disk. A process is that piece of code actually executing in memory. Okay? So, I already said this last time. Any program you may have on disk may be associated with multiple execution instances, each of which is its own process. Okay? So, each has its own distinct state, for example. Okay, so, a process state, what's the state of a process? It contains all of the following things. It contains the code for running the program. It contains the global variables that are associated with that program. It contains space for the heap. Okay, this is a part of memory that is dynamically managed. It needs space for the stack, the execution stack, which is the program's call chain. Okay, this includes the stack frames and the stack pointers. Okay, there has to be a program counter associated with the process that tells you what is the execution, what's the instruction that is currently being executed. Okay, there are values of CPU registers, okay, the OS resources such as files, and then there is the process execution state itself. What's the current state of this process? Okay, so all of these things constitute the state of a process. So now let's look at this in a little more detail. So let's assume this is your program, okay, that you have written. Okay, this is just a very simple program. There's a main function and that calls another function X, which does something. Okay, you compile this program, okay, and then you get an executable, and that's what gets loaded into memory when you run the program. Okay, and this is what the state of that process looks like when it's executing in memory. Okay, there's what is called the code segment or the text segment. Okay, these are the instructions that correspond to your program. Okay, I have shown those instructions in source format. What you actually have in there are assembly instructions that correspond to this source. Okay, but for simplicity, let's just look at the source. Okay, then there's the stack segment. Okay, in this case, I'm showing that the stack is growing upwards. Okay, and this is basically the stack contains local variables for each function. That's the call chain that is shown. Okay, there's a main, and main is actually called X, and this is where the program counter is. Okay, so your stack should have two stack frames, one corresponding to the main program and one corresponding to X, which is shown here. That's the first stack frame, that's the second stack frame. The stack pointer always points to the top of the stack. Okay, the heap is shown growing downwards. Okay, it starts at the high memory region and starts growing downwards. Okay, and that is any dynamically allocated variables, okay, that are maintained on the heap. Okay, so when your process is actually executing, okay, that's what is stored in memory. Okay, there's a lot more that I haven't shown here. Okay, there's the OS kernel itself, which also resides in memory. I haven't shown what that is. I have not shown what are the data structures maintained by kernel. There may be more than one process. Okay, there typically will be tens of processes, but this is just the picture that you have for a single process. Okay, but lot more resides in memory than this. Okay, is this clear? Any questions on this? So what I've shown here are three what are called segments. When we come to memory management, we will revisit these segments. There's a text segment or the code segment. That's the region of memory that contains the code. There's the stack segment. That's the region of memory that contains the stack. And that's called the heap segment. That's the region of memory that contains the heap. Okay, there's also a data segment that may be used to store global variables. Okay, these are variables that can be accessed by any function. Okay, that may be also in there. There may be many other segments, okay, for shared memory and so on. Here I have only shown three. Okay, when we revisit this topic in memory management, we'll look at this notion in more detail. Okay, so now let's look at this notion of a process execution state. As I mentioned, the process state itself contains many things. So it contains the code and the stack and the heap and the registers and so on. And there's also this thing called the process execution state. This is the current state of the process. Okay, so let's see what this is in more detail. Okay, so the execution state of a process indicates what this process is doing at that instant. A process can be in any of these five states. It could be in the new state, running, ready, waiting, or terminated. In the new state, whenever you start a new process, it begins in the new state. In this state, the OS is currently setting up the process state. It is loading the program in memory. It is setting up kernel data structures that are needed for the process to begin execution. Okay? So you always start a process in the new state. Okay? As soon as the process has been set up by the operating system, it will then go into the ready state. Okay? In this state, the process is ready to run. Okay? And it is waiting for the CPU. Okay? Just because a process is ready doesn't mean it will start executing immediately. There may be other processes that are also ready. So it's a task of the operating system kernel to pick one process, okay, and have it execute. It will pick one of the ready processes and have it execute. The number of processes that are executing will depend on the number of cores you have. Okay, in the simplest core, you may have a uniprocessor machine, in which case there's only one CPU. So at any given instant, you can have only one process that is actually running. Okay, so there may be many in the ready state, okay, but only one may be chosen to run. So at some point, okay, the operating system kernel is going to say, okay, you are ready, so now it's time for you to actually run. Okay, so then you make a transition from ready to running, and here is where you actually start executing. Okay, so you'll take the code of the program and start executing it sequentially. Okay? Now from the running state, you may make a transition to a wait state. Okay, suppose that you start doing some I.O. Okay? When you do I.O., you cannot run anymore. Okay, you are waiting for this I.O. in task to finish. Okay, so maybe you opened a file for reading or writing. Okay, so you sent off a read or a write instruction. This causes the process to block. Okay, because this you have to wait for this task to finish. So you make a transition to the wait state. Okay, so in the waiting state, you are waiting for some event to finish. Typically, this event is I.O., but it need not be. You may be waiting for a synchronization primitive. You may be waiting to grab a lock or a semaphore. All concepts that we will learn in the next few classes. Okay? So if you wait for anything whatsoever, okay, you will go from the running to the wait state. Okay? You will wait for something. Okay? Then you make a transition here. At some later point in time, that event will actually occur, meaning that the read or the write will finish, or you may actually get a lock or a semaphore, in which case you will again make a transition from wait to ready, meaning now you are again ready to run. Okay? And then at some later point, you will again make a transition to run. When the OS kernel decides you can execute again, you will execute some more instructions, and this cycle will continue. Okay, until your program finishes execution, and then you go to the terminate state. Okay? Is this clear? Is there any question? Yes, question.
What would be the instance where it goes from running back to running?
Yes, good question. So that was a question I would have asked. So why would you ever go directly from the running to the ready state? If you are always, if you start running, then why not just run to completion if there is nothing for you to wait on? Okay, why would you ever have this transition? Right, so you have to do time slicing. So this is a concept we have not yet studied in this course. Okay, we will look at this in the next few classes when we do process scheduling. Okay, the answer is very simple. If a process gets to run, and if it can run to completion, there may be processes that will never give up the CPU. So suppose you write an infinite loop. Okay, this program will never terminate. If the process goes to run state and it is not made to relinquish the CPU by the OS kernel, then it is just going to occupy the CPU forever. Nothing else in your system will run. Okay? In order to be fair to all running, all ready processes, what the OS kernel does is it switches between processes one at a time. Okay? So whenever a process is given the CPU, it is also given a fixed time slot, saying you can run, but you cannot run for longer than a certain time. This is called the time quantum or the scheduling quantum. Okay? If you run and use up your entire quantum, then you have to give up the CPU and let some other process run. Okay? This is for fairness, to ensure that all processes get to run. Okay? So if you use up your quantum, you will basically just, you will not go to wait state because you are still ready to run. There is nothing you are blocking on. The CPU, you just have to give up the CPU, saying it's someone else's turn. So you make a transition back to the ready and you wait for your turn again. Okay? Is that going to answer your question? Yes, question.
I just get an idea of the time slots that you're talking about. Are these measured in milliseconds or
Right. So question about what is the size of the quantum, I'll talk about that in a couple of slides, but typically it depends on the OS kernel. It's also a parameter you could set in the OS kernel. Linux uses quantum sizes of around 200 milliseconds. Okay. Other operating systems use quantums of 10 milliseconds. Okay. Depends on what exactly you are trying to optimize. I'll talk about that in just 1 second, how to choose the quantum and what it means. Okay, when you talk about context switches. Okay. Is this clear? All of these arrows should be clear. Okay. So why do you ever go back from running to ready? How do you go to waiting and so on? Okay. So now let's take an actual program. Okay. This is the program that we want to now track. Okay. That program just prints hello world and exits. Okay. It's going to just print one line on your screen and exit. Okay, now let's say you compile this program and you start it up. Okay, what are all the state transitions it's going to make? And that list is shown there. Okay, that's the picture I had in the previous slide. So it is going to start a new. Okay, this is when the OS is loading this program, start setting up a new process to execute this program. Okay, when it's done doing that, this process is going to make a transition to ready, saying I'm ready to run. Okay, and you have to wait for your turn. Because there may be other processes that are ready. At some point, the OS kernel is going to pick this process for execution, at which time you will make the transition to running. Okay, you go from ready to running. Okay, so now you start execution, and you execute the first instruction, or the first line of code. This is basically printf. Okay, so this tries to just print hello world to the screen. That's IO. Okay, so you are immediately going to block. Okay, because you invoke your system call saying print this string on the screen, okay, and then you have to block. So you make a transition from running to waiting for IO. Okay, so you just may go make this transition and you wait for the system call to finish. Okay, the system call is eventually going to execute. It will print that string onto the screen, during which time the process is just waiting. Okay, you are not, process isn't doing anything. If you remember, I said system calls are executed by the kernel. So it's the kernel's job to take this string, display it on the screen and whatnot. Okay, at some point in time, okay, this instruction or this IO event is going to finish. Okay, so at the which point you will again, this process makes a transition back to the ready state. Okay, it's ready to run. Okay, at some later point, the kernel will pick it to run again, and then you run, and then there's nothing more to do. Okay, so you will basically just terminate at this point. So these are the sequence of transitions this very simple process makes, okay, from the start to the finish. Okay, notice that there was no transition from running to ready because there was only one instruction here that was basically doing IO. If there were compute instructions and they were longer than the time slice, then you would have to make some of those transitions. Okay, yes.
So every instruction would be a cycle through ready, running, and waiting.
The question is every instruction a cycle through ready, running, waiting? That's not the case. Okay. So it's not like one instruction takes one quantum. So what happens is when you are going to running state, you are given a time quantum. Okay, let's say 200 milliseconds. Each instruction takes on the order of microsecond. So you will execute many instructions until you hit an IO event or your quantum ends. Okay? So you may actually execute a whole bunch of them, and if your time quantum expires, then you go back to ready. Okay? Or if you go do any IO event, you go. It's not like one instruction causes that cycle. One quantum causes you to basically go back to ready state, or if you block on anything, you go to waiting state. Okay? Yes.
I know, like, in cooperative multitasking, there was, that's the only way to do it, but I know, I'm wondering if cooperative multitasking would be involved.
Right, so question is there a way to voluntarily give up the CPU? Okay. Now, many operating systems have this call called yield. Okay.
Yeah.
So, many operating systems still support it. Okay. If you actually say yield, what that does is it automatically takes you back from the running to the ready. You say, I don't want to use the rest of my quantum. I'm willing to give it up. Okay. Now, you may use this for a variety of reasons, which we will talk about when we do threading and cooperative processes. Okay. Typically, you don't worry about such things. You let the OS kernel handle all the quantums, and you are not even aware that there is a quantum. But if you are writing an application that involves multiple processes, and careful coordination between these processes, you may want more control over what process from your group gets to run, and then you may use these calls like yield, okay, which for the purposes of this course you don't need to worry about it. Okay, so let's assume they don't exist until we come to it later. But yes, that's supported in most kernels actually. Any other questions here? Yeah. Now the question for us is, now this is how a process makes transition. So now it's interesting to understand what is happening under the hoods. Okay. How is the process making these transitions? What is the kernel doing to help it make this transition? Okay. Now it turns out what happens is within the kernel, okay, there is one queue for each of those states. Okay. And any process that's in that state has to be in that queue. Okay, so the OS manages these multiple active processes using state queues. Okay, there is one for each, and I'll show you a picture of how all of this works in just one moment. Okay, so before I actually talk about those queues, I need to tell you what is on those queues. Okay, and there are some kernel data structures that we need to understand first, and then we'll come back to the notion of state queues. Okay, so for how does the kernel keep track of active processes? Okay, there are kernel data structures that it has to maintain, one for each process. Okay, this is called a process control block. Okay, for every active process in your system, there is an entry in this data structure. Okay, there's one per process, and this entry is referred to as the process control block. The process control block has all of the information that the kernel needs to know about this process. Okay. In particular, each process control block has this information in it. Okay. It has the process ID. Okay. This is the unique ID for every running process in your system. Okay. It has the state of that process. What is this process doing? Is it ready? It's running? Is it waiting? Okay. It has the program counter for this process. What is the current value of this register? Okay. That's tracked in this process control block. It has the start pointer as well as all of the register values. Okay, it has memory management information like page tables. Okay, again, this page table data structures we'll study later, but they're all stored in the process control block. There has to be the owner of the process. Okay, who owns this process? Okay, you need to know who is the parent process. We'll come back to that. Okay, what are the files this process is executing? Okay, what is the scheduling priority for this process? Okay, what's the I/O status of this process? So everything is tracked by the kernel. Okay, so there's one such entry for every active process. So the kernel knows precisely what each process is doing, where does it reside in memory. Okay, that's stored in the memory management, because the kernel needs to know where is this process loaded in memory. Okay, what is it doing, what are the values of the registers, and so on. So a new entry is created every time a process starts up. Okay, this is why there is the new state. In the new state, what's happening is the kernel is doing two things. It's setting up a new entry in a new process control block, and number two, it's actually loading that program from disk into memory. Okay, this is why you have to start in the new state where this setup happens, and then once you have a new entry created for you and your process program has been loaded, the process is actually ready to begin execution. Okay. And when the process finishes, its corresponding entry in the PCB is deleted. Okay. So this is the kernel data structure you need to know about. And now we'll see how the operating system kernel manipulates the process control block. Okay. Are there any questions here? Okay. So let's look at how you make this transition. So we'll come back to the notion of state queues now. Okay. So each process has to be in one of these five states, any active process: new, ready, running, waiting, or terminated. Okay? And for each of these states, the kernel maintains a queue. And what's in this queue is all the processes that are in that state. So in the ready queue, you have all processes that are in the ready state. Okay? In the run queue, you have all processes that are currently executing. Okay? If you have only one processor on your system, your run queue will always have one entry and no more than one entry. If you are a dual core laptop, your ready queue or running queue may have two entries, up to two entries, because you can have up to two processes executing and so on. So the number of entries in the running queue cannot exceed the number of processors on your system. Okay? That should be clear. Yes, question.
What about like simultaneous multi-threading?
So there's this question about simultaneous multi-threading. So in simultaneous multi-threading, a process can have multiple threads. Okay, that could be simultaneously executing on the processor. Okay, but there's still only one process. Okay, we will come back to next class. I'm going to introduce the notion of threads. Then we'll come back to this notion of what threads mean and how they execute. Okay, but let's hold off on that. Okay, so for each of these, so if you are logged on I/O, then you are in one of the I/O queues. Okay, every device on your system will have one I/O queue associated with it. There will be a queue associated with the disk. There will be a queue associated with, let's say, any other device. You may have CD-ROM, the graphics card, the network card. If you are waiting on an I/O event on that device, you go and wait in that queue. Okay? And then terminated is again a queue of all the processes that are finished and are just waiting for cleanup. Okay? Meaning deallocation of memory, deletion of the process control block and so on. Okay? So whenever you make a transition from one queue to another, that PCB entry is actually removed from that queue and it goes into another queue. Yes, question.
What it says the PCB, when the OS changes the state of process, PCBs are making this turn queue. So these PCBs are per process?
Yes, so PCB is a per process entry.
So it's not the global process table, that's another
no. Structure. So, yes, so that's what I'm showing here. Okay, so. Yes, you have a question?
Is there any circumstances where there's multiple instances of the same program listed in the queue?
Okay. Question is, can there be multiple instances of the same program in a queue? Absolutely. Because you may start the same program twice. You could have two instances of Firefox going. These are two independent processes. They are both doing Firefox. Okay? Each has its own process control block. So you may have two Firefox entries. Independent processes. So long as they are independent processes, you can have as many of them as you can. Yes, I will show you just in one second what's happening on this machine. We can take a look at that. Okay, so this is the ready, just to show you what the state queues look like. This is the ready queue. The way it is implemented here, or way it's shown here, is a doubly linked list. Okay, it could be an array, doesn't matter. Most flexible data structure is a doubly linked list. This shows you all these processes that are ready, in the ready state. Any one of them can be chosen for execution. Okay, so this is process X, L, A, you just name them, given them some arbitrary names. Okay, here is a wait queue for a device. Let's assume this is the disk. Okay, these are all processes that are doing some file I/O. Okay, they're either reading or writing to some files on disk, and while they are doing that, they may wait in this queue. So once that I/O task finishes, they will go back, that entry is going to move from here back to that. Each entry here, this is a process. Okay, this is the process control block for K, which has all of that information I showed you. Okay. So what was referred to as the process table, okay, is really a set of doubly linked lists. Okay, you can think of this as a table, but it's really a list. Because entries move from one queue to another, you have to manage them dynamically. So it's better to manage them as a linked list rather than some other data structure. Okay, but different kernels make their own decisions. Okay, is this clear? Yes, you have a question there.
So when a process goes from the wait queue to the ready queue, it goes right to the tail?
Yes, good question. So question is, when it goes from the wait queue to the ready queue, should it go to the tail or somewhere else? So this is where the policy that the operating system uses to manage this queue comes into the picture. Okay, so I just said here, but didn't really explain, is saying you can use different policies to manage each queue. Okay? Now typically what you do is, if you go from the wait queue, it seems like for fairness reasons you should go to the end of the queue. Okay? That's what is typically done. But that's not what's always done, because there may be things like process priorities. Okay? This may be a process with higher priority than those other processes. In which case, when it goes into the queue, it may actually go to the front of the queue, not at the end of the queue. Because if the OS wants to give this process higher priority to run. Okay? So there will be scheduling policies that are used. Okay? When we talk about process scheduling, again, we'll see how priorities make a difference and so on. Okay, so if these processes were all same priority, then you would go to the end of the queue. So that way everybody gets a fair turn. But if some processes are more important than others, then you may not go to the tail. You may go somewhere else. Okay, in priority order. Okay, any other questions here? Yes, question there.
With respect to priorities, are there other attributes like assigned, like a longer time schedule?
Yes. So a question about how priorities work, again something we will look at when we talk about scheduling algorithm. So there is the notion of priorities, and there is also the notion of starvation. Okay, you want to respect priorities, but you want to be fair. You don't want some process to keep starving. So there is always a dynamic process that says that you will respect priorities, but if some processes are getting starved, you may dynamically raise their priorities to let them run for at least a little bit. Okay, so there are all these optimizations that the scheduler will do to ensure fairness, okay, despite having priorities. Okay, so just to give you a quick example, let's look at this process table here. Okay, just one second. Oh, it's very weird. Process monitor seems to, okay, there it is. Okay, so here, so there were some questions about multiple processes, right? So let's look at if there is something which is running twice. So here are some processes that are running, right? There's PowerPoint, and so here are two instances of the same program. Okay, so the exact same program, there are two instances, each has a unique process ID. Okay, so just as I said, you could start two versions of Firefox, there's two instances of this running. So you could have multiple of these running. Okay, and each is a unique process. So you can see
like an MD worker.
Sorry?
MD worker.
Yeah, there are two instances of that. That's what I was saying. Yeah. So there may be many such processes where are multiple instances. So I think I only one Firefox running, but if I could start another one, it would do the same thing. Okay? Yes, your question there.
If you have two instances of the same program, do they share the same program text, or is there two copies for them?
Right. Question is, if there are two instances of the same program, do they share the program text, or are there two copies? So the picture that you will see in the memory is as follows. Okay, so let's say this is program A, and this is program B. Okay. Each will have its own code segment. Okay, so this is the code segment which will have main and so on. Okay, so there will, so if at some level these are independent text segment, they just happen to be identical. Okay, because they are two copies of the same program or two processes that basically share the same or they're executing the same program, but each has its own independent text segment. Okay, they are not sharing it at this level. Okay. But what happens internally is that the program actually resides on disk. It's a file on disk. Okay. What the OS is doing is using something called memory map, which is basically mapping this code segment to that disk file. Okay. So they are both mapped onto the same file because it's the same program. Okay. So whenever you have to fetch some part of this code segment, you'll go to that file and fetch it. Okay. But there will be independent copies residing in memory. Hey, if this is a multi-threaded application, again something we'll talk about next time, then you will share the code segment. If it's independent processes, then you have your own copy of the code segment. Only if you have multiple threads within the same address space, do you share the code segment. Okay? Okay. So let's now talk about, so we said that the process control block is a set of queues. One for each state. Now let's look at how all of these queues are manipulated by the operating system kernel. Okay. So for this, you have to understand this notion of what is called a context switch. Okay. Context switch is an operation where the operating system kernel suspends the execution of one process and begins the execution of a different process. Okay. There may be many reasons why you are suspending the execution of one process and starting another. The process may have used its quantum or its time slice. So it's time to give someone else a turn to run on the CPU. So in this case, you'll suspend that process, put it back into the ready queue, start a new process. Or that process may have blocked on an IO event. In this case, also you have to suspend its execution, put it in the wait queue and take some other process from the ready queue and have it run. Okay? This process of switching from one process, this operation, or switching from one process to another is called a context switch. Okay? And it's a relatively expensive operation. Okay? What does it involve? Okay? So since you're suspending the execution of one process, you have to take all of its current state and you have to save it somewhere. so that when it executes, starts executing again at some later time, it begins exactly where it left off, because you're suspending, you're not terminating. You're temporarily stopping that process from executing. Okay? So you have to set everything that the process contains here somewhere. Where do you store it? You store it in the PCB. Okay? So as I mentioned, the PCB basically contains the entire state of the process. It has the state of the registers, it has the program counter, stack pointer. So you will take the program counter, you will store it in the process control block. Okay, this is in main memory. Okay, take the stack pointer, you save it here. Take all the registers, you put it in the process control block. Take any memory management information from the register, stick it there and so on. Okay, so you will do this. And then you pick another process that's on the ready queue. Okay, and say now it's that process's turn to begin execution. Okay, but before it can begin execution, you have to load its state from the process control block into the registers. Okay, so you'll go to the PCB, you'll take its program counter, you'll load it into the program counter register. You'll take all of the register values you saved, you'll reload them into the corresponding registers. You'll take all the memory management information, put them into any memory management registers, and so on. Once you have done this, then you can actually begin execution of that process, because then the process basically begins where it left off. Okay? So the task of saving all of the process state into the PCB and loading the new process state from the PCB into the registers and whatnot is what happens during a context switch. Okay? Now this takes several operations because you are doing loads and stores of registers. Okay? And while you are doing this, the CPU is not doing anything useful. It's basically trying to save the state of one process and load the state of another process. It's not executing any process. Okay? So this is effectively wasted time. Okay? Because basically you stop executing a process, you are doing this bookkeeping, and then you start executing another process. The longer this bookkeeping takes, more is the overhead, that more is the tax you are paying. Okay? So you want to ensure that the context switch overhead is amortized as much as possible. Okay, and this has an implication on how long the time slices. Yes, question.
If you use multiple cores, sort of furthermore, as in the sense of not using the two cores as if there were two cores, but as if there were one, mm-hmm. and one sort of be the lackey of the other, loading the process and doing all this stuff in the background. That way, when a context switch happens, you can just switch control back and forth with that.
Right. So you are asking the question of if you had multiple cores, can you just have one core doing the execution, the other core doing all of it?
Yeah.
But then you are still wasting one core of processing power, right? So typically you want both cores going running full steam. Okay, so if you want to make full use of your machine, that's what you would ideally want to do. But every time you have to wait and do a context switch, you are basically the CPU, that core is not doing anything useful. It is basically loading, yes.
Yeah.
Right. So is this clear? So the issue is, how do you ensure that the overhead of a context switch is amortized as much as possible? And the way you do this is by choosing your time slice or quantum duration accordingly. Okay? The larger your quantum duration, the smaller is the overall overhead. So suppose you take 1 millisecond to do a context switch. Okay, that's the time it takes you to save all the registers and load a new set of registers and have another process execution. So if you use your time slice to be 10 milliseconds, okay, then you have 10% context switch overhead. For every 10 milliseconds of execution, you have 1 millisecond of context switch time. 1 millisecond of effectively time where the CPU does not do anything useful. Okay. If instead you chose your time slice to be 100 milliseconds, context switch is still 1 millisecond. Now your context switch overhead has gone down to 1%, down from 10%. Okay? Is that clear? So your amortized is wasted work or not useful work over a larger amount of useful work. The time slice is where something useful is happening, some process is executing. The context switch is time where nothing useful is happening, because you are basically doing bookkeeping. Okay? So you want to choose your context, your time slice, such that the context switch overhead is as small as possible. Okay? This suggests that you should make the time slice arbitrarily large. Okay? Because if you said I choose it to be 1000 milliseconds, which is 1 second, then it's 0.1%. If I choose it to be 10 seconds, then it's 0.01%. Okay? But if you make the time slice arbitrarily large, then your scheduling becomes very coarse grained. Okay, because processes will wait on the ready queue for long periods of time before they can run. Okay, this means that your system will not seem very interactive. You do a mouse click. Okay, you will have to wait 1 second before that process even gets to run and start processing your mouse click. Okay, so from an interactivity perspective, it's good to have your time slice as small as possible. Okay, because you want your system to respond quickly. The only way it responds quickly is each process that wants to run gets to run quickly and makes some progress. Okay? But as I said, the smaller you make it, the more is the context switch over it. So you're spending more wasted time. So choosing the time slice carefully is always an important system parameter. Okay? You neither want it too small, because then the context switch overhead becomes large. Neither do you want it too large, in which case the interactivity of the system seems to be bad or poor. Okay, so choosing this carefully is always very important. Okay, and when we talk about process scheduling, we'll see how to choose context switch time slice. Okay, so typically your typical operating system may do between 100 to 1000 context switches a second. Actually, that should be somewhere between 10 to 1000, because in Linux the time slice is 200 milliseconds. Okay, that means you can do up to 5 context switches a second if everyone used their time slice. Typically that does not happen. You basically run and then you may block before your time slice expires. Okay, so you will have some tens of context switches happening in Linux. If you have more fine-grained scheduling, like in Solaris where the time slice is around 10 milliseconds, then you may have more context switches happening. So you are sort of higher up on this scale. Okay, but as I said, that comes at the expense of more expensive overhead in terms of context switching. Okay. Yes, question.
Do you know all the processes are doing IO, and how do you counteract that?
Okay. So if all of the processes are doing IO, so we'll come back to when we do scheduling, we'll see how do you choose a scheduling algorithm that is more favorable for IO bound tasks rather than CPU bound. But the answer is very simple. If most of the processes are doing IO, okay, then it's highly likely that your ready queue is going to be mostly empty, because most of them are sitting in the wait queue, they're not in the ready queue. So IO is a slow operation. Okay, disks, most of these devices are slow. Okay, CPU is relatively fast. Okay, so you will block on IO, you will go in the wait queue. Okay, so your ready queue is more or less empty most of the time. So if some process becomes ready to run, no matter what the scheduler is, that's the only process in the ready queue. Okay, so it gets to run immediately. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is if your system is highly IO bound, the CPU scheduling algorithm does not matter, because you are basically down to first come first serve, which is there's only one process, there's nothing else to pick, that's the process that gets to run. Okay, something to think about. We'll talk about that in next time. Yes.
Well, in that sort of thing, would you want to have to sort of look at the situation and say, okay, the ready queue's dropped below this threshold, I'm just going to like give it, you know, triple a quanta or something. Right. That way you're not
Yeah. Okay, so you are trying to ask the question, how do you change the time slice based on the length of the ready queue or what you are seeing. So we will see the typical scheduling algorithm that is used is called multi-level feedback. We will talk about that next time. That does precisely that. Okay. When there are more CPU bound tasks, it gives them longer quantum. When there are IO bound tasks, it gives them shorter quantum, and it tries to optimize for both. Okay, that's exactly what the most operating systems will do. Okay, so the next concept we are going to talk about is how to create processes in this system. Okay, so we talked about the notion of process states. We talked about how you make these transitions from one state to another. We talked about this notion of switching from one process to another. But we never said how does a process get created in the first place. Okay, and that's what we are going to talk about now. Okay, so the only way for a process to be created is that some other process has to initiate this process. Okay, so there's always a parent process that will start off a child. Okay, processes don't appear magically. Some other process has to start up this process. Okay, so the creator is always called the parent process, and the new process is called the child process. Okay, so the parent basically defines the resources and privileges that this child process gets. Typically, this is the scheduling priorities and so on. Okay, So the way typically you create a process, any process can create a child process. The way you do this is using the fork system call in Unix, and there's an equivalent create process call in Windows. Okay? If any process executes this call, it basically starts off a child, it forks off a child. Okay? And what happens when you do a fork is that the fork system call creates an identical copy of the parent process. Okay? And the only difference between the parent and the child, and this is basically what the child process is, the only difference is that the child process gets its own unique ID, process ID. Okay? And then the parent and child can do different things. Okay? Now, what does the fork system call itself return? In the parent process, the fork system call returns the process ID of the child process that was just created. So the parent knows what is its child. Okay? And in the child process, the return value is zero for the fork system call. And I'll just show you a picture as to why this matters at all. Okay? And once the parent has created a child process, then it can either do its own thing, it can do some other stuff, or it can wait for its child to finish execution. And this is done using the wait call. Okay, if you execute wait after you do a fork, then you're waiting for your child to finish. Okay, then you're going to be in the IO queue. Once the child finishes, the parent can continue. Okay. And the child process often will also use another call called exec to do something useful. Okay, it is not very useful to just create identical copies of the same parent process. Okay, then the child process is not doing something useful. Typically, you will do an exec to do something else. Again, I will show you a sequence of steps as to how all of this works. Okay, so let me just show you a picture or some code here to show how fork works. Okay, so this is some C code. Okay, C++ looks very similar. There are only two things that matter here. Okay, there is this fork call, and then there is this if statement. Okay, these are the two most important parts of this program. Okay, when this process starts up and when it executes this fork, a new copy of this exact same process is created. Okay, so that's the child process. The child process has the same code segment. The child is executing the same program as the parent. Okay, now you have two processes that are doing exactly the same thing at this point. The child has everything similar, meaning that the child's program counter is going to be the same. It's a duplicate. It's a mirror image of the parent as the child process. Okay. From this point on, the parent and the child are going to do different things. The reason for that is the fork system call is going to return different values in return values in the parent and the child. In the parent, the fork system call is going to give you the process ID of the child process that was just created. Okay, so the parent knows what's the process ID of the child. In the child process, fork returns zero. This is the definition of how fork works. And as a result of this, this if statement will do different things in the parent and the child. Okay, because this says if CID equals zero, okay, then you execute this, otherwise you execute this. Okay? Now in the parent process, you will have a non-zero process ID that has been returned. Okay? So the parent process is then going to go and execute this part of the code. Okay? In the child process, I said fork returns zero. As a result of this, the child process executes this code, not this code. Okay, and that these two things do different things. As you will see, the child calls something called exec, and then I'll just talk about what that does in a moment, while the parent process calls, in this case, it sleeps and waits for the child to finish. Okay? Is the concept of a fork clear? What does the fork do? It basically creates a mirror image of the parent process. Okay, this is called a child process. Yes, question.
If the child calls a child, wouldn't they both have the same CID as zero?
Okay, good question. I'll talk about that in a moment. So let's actually talk about it right now rather than coming back to it. Okay. So, let's just take the part of the code. Parent did a fork. Okay, and you say if CID equal to zero. Right? That's what you're saying. And then, so this is the child execution and this is the parent. The parent has done something. So what the parent may, the child may do anything. It could, if it wants, it could also do a fork. Okay? What will this fork do? Yes.
Wouldn't this child ID be the parent of the new process ID, which if it returns zero, then you'd have another if statement with a zero.
Yes.
So your I is not going to be zero. Your I is going to be the child's actual process.
Right. So now you are in the thing, assume that, forget about the parent, okay? So at this point, the parent has formed the child. Let's not even assume this parent exists anymore. I mean, let's forget that it even is there. So this is what the child is doing. It's executing a fresh fork call, okay? So for all practical purposes, let's just erase all of this. Okay, this is the child call. It's done a fork. There will be two copies of this child. So there is this original parent. This is the child. Okay, and the child did another fork. Okay, so let's call this guy grandchild. Okay, so child has it. So this becomes a parent of this process. So what this fork is doing, going to do exactly what happened in the parent. It's going to create a copy of this process. Okay, that's this new process. And this fork is going to return a different value in this process and that process. Okay, so here you would have to have again the same if else that was there in the parent. Think of it as recursion. Yes, this is a separate fork call. You put that fork call in here. So that's the original fork call. The child came and did another fork here. Okay, or it
in CID instead of CID, and then that's how you could tell between them.
Yes, exactly. So you have to check whatever the second fork returns you. You store that in some other variable, you check. It will have value of the grandchild process ID here, and it will return zero. So here you would have to have the same if else in here, recursively. Okay. Yes, question.
If fork fails, if for any reason it's not able to do it, would it return something other than zero?
Yes. If the fork fails, it will return a negative value. So you should actually check if it fails, which this program doesn't do. Fork can fail. Okay. If there are not enough resources, if your process control block entry could not be created because you run out of memory, you will get system exhaustion. Fork will fail. Okay. Okay, is that clear? So now, as I said, you created a child process, but you want the child to do something useful. It's not useful to just have an identical copy of the parent. Okay? So in this, most of the time, what the child does is it calls something, a call called an exec. And the exec has to have a program name associated with it, as is shown here. Okay? Then what the exec does is it basically has the child process call that program and execute that program for you. Okay? And this is the basically, the fork and the exec pairs are basically how you create new processes. Okay? So now let's walk through what would happen. So there are two examples. Okay? What happens when you type a command on the command line, and what happens when you double click a program icon? Okay? So let's take the double click example. All of you are probably familiar. Let's suppose you are double clicking on Firefox. What is happening? When you double click on Firefox, some process, let's say it's the GUI process, is going to do a fork because you need to start a new process. You just double clicked on an icon. Okay? A child process is created. This child process is a copy of the parent process. It is basically the same GUI program running. Okay? But now you want the child to execute whatever you double clicked on. In this case, you double clicked Firefox. Okay? So what that child process will do is then it will call exec Firefox. This will cause the child process to start executing Firefox rather than executing instructions of the parent. Okay? Because exec is basically an execute command. It basically says, forget about whatever you are executing. Instead, replace your code segment with this new process, new program, and start executing that program instead. Okay? So you will, in the child process, wipe out the entire memory that was already loaded and load a new program in. Okay, and start executing that program from the beginning. Okay? This is how you will start a new child process that does something. Okay, is that clear? Okay, question.
This is Unix only,
but the similar concept in most operating systems. You have a notion of creating a child and having the child do something. Okay. This is the part where the child does something. You double clicked on Firefox, child executes Firefox. Okay, so if you basically, same thing is true when you start, when you type something onto a command line. Okay, you put your terminal, let's say you type ls. Okay, what has happened? The terminal program which is executing a shell will actually do a fork. Okay? This fork creates a copy of the shell process. In the child process, then you want to execute whatever command you specified on the command. And if it was ls, then you ask the child to do exec ls. So in this case, the child process will actually load ls and start executing it. Okay, is this clear? If it's not clear, ask. So I'll show you some examples in just a moment. Okay, so here is first what's happening on the fork. Okay, this was our process that I just showed you, the code that I just showed you, this code. Okay, this is the original process, the parent process. So here you come and execute fork. At this point, the operating system takes this entire memory region and just creates a new copy, which is this process. Okay, this is a new process that has just been created. Okay, these two look exactly the same. The same code segment, everything is the same at the time of the fork. Now from this point on, things are going to be slightly different. This fork, so there is a fork call in the child and the fork call in the parent, because they are exactly the same process. The program counter is also at fork in both places, because everything is the same. Okay? The only thing that is going to be different is when this fork finishes in the parent, this call is going to return the process ID of that child process. Okay, that has its own ID. Okay? And when this process, the child process executes, and the fork finishes here, okay, same fork, this is going to return a value of 0. This is the only difference between the parent and the child. And this is how the child distinguishes that it's a child, because it got a 0 value, it knows that it's a different from the parent. Okay. So you can check the return value of fork and do something else in the child. That's exactly what we did here. Okay. So if the return value is 0, you know you are in the child process. So then you execute. In this case, you execute the if statement. Okay? The parent executes the else statement. Okay, so independent processes, but now they are starting to do different things. The parent is executing some other code, child is executing some other code. Okay, in the child, you want to now do something useful, because this is just the same process. So here you call an exec. Suppose you call exec Firefox. Okay? This is yet another system call. As soon as you do exec Firefox, what the operating system does is it basically cleans out this entire memory region. This code program goes away. It takes the Firefox program and it loads it here. Okay? It reinitializes all the registers and starts executing Firefox from the first instruction. Okay? So the exec is basically something that takes the existing memory region of the process and it overwrites it with a new program and starts executing that program from the beginning. Okay? This is how a parent can launch a Firefox process or some any other process for that matter. Okay? Yes, question.
So exec LP is the one that wipes out.
Yes.
Not a fork.
No. Fork just makes a mirror copy.
Right.
So yeah. Fork is basically at the fork, the parent, the child is just going to do this. The child hadn't done an exec there. This is exactly what would continue executing. You could have just done some other things in here. But typically, with the fork, you also have an exec in the child. The moment you do an exec, it will load that program and override this memory region with that program and start executing that new program in this process. Same process, but it just overrides the memory region with a new program and starts executing it. Yes?
If everything is overwritten, how would it return a value back to the...
How does it return a value? In the wait, there's nothing being returned from the child to the parent.
Okay.
The only thing that is being returned is that this is a, think of this as a function. The same function is executing in the child and the parent. The function behaves differently in the child and in the parent. That's all. The child and the parent are not communicating. Okay, they are independent processes. They can do their own thing. The only thing is the OS knows that this is the parent process for the child process. Beyond this, these are two independent processes in the system. Okay. Any questions here? Is this clear what the exec? There are two important concepts. How to start a process and how does the process do something different from the parent. For that you have to do an exec call and that allows the process to load a new program and start executing it. Okay. This is the mechanism by which everything in your system works. Okay. This is how new processes are created. This is how. So every process has to be started by some parent process and nothing magic. Okay. You cannot just have a process without a parent. Everything has to have a parent. Right? Clear? So we can take a quick look at the. So if you are on a Linux machine, okay, if you do something called a PS tree, that tells you what the parent-child relationships are. I don't know if it is installed, but sorry. So here this is PS, this is what PS tree is returned. Okay. So init process is the process that starts up when your machine boots up. This is the granddaddy of all processes. It has process ID either 0 or 1. Everything is started by init, and then you have, so this has started these processes, then there's a cron tab that started this process, that started this process. This is your parent-child hierarchy on your machine. Okay. So you will see there are all these things running. So here is IMAPD, so this is, and then here is SSH running, and that has, there's a SSH daemon that started a shell and I executed PS tree. Right? So everything is has, so this is the parent of this, this is the parent of this. So this bash did a fork, it created a new bash child process. That child process executed this program called PS tree, and that basically is this process, and this is the output of this process. So this is how parent-child relationships are maintained. Okay. Now if your parent terminates, yes, for any reason, but the child is still running, then you have to be assigned a new parent. Okay, because there always has to be a parent. But your parent may decide to exit before the child exits. In which case you may actually get assigned to init or your original login shell or some such thing. Okay, because there always has to be a default parent-child relationships in your system. Any other questions? Same thing happens when you do double click. Okay, I just showed you what happens when I typed a new program. If you double click, there's a launch daemon that's going to start off your process. It'll fork and then do an exec. Okay. So process termination. Any process can terminate itself by calling the exit system call, or you can also use the kill system call to terminate some other process in your system. Yeah, so you can, just as you can start a process, okay, you can also terminate processes. Okay, you can terminate yourself by calling exit, and this process that called exit will finish. It will go to the terminate state. But you can also call kill to kill a process, and here is an example. So this is an example of a parent starting a child process, and the child, then the parent then goes and kills the child process. Okay, so the way it does is you do a fork, okay, and then the fork is going to create a copy of this process, okay, and it's going to return the PID of the child process in the parent, and the child will get a 0. So in the child, what you do is you go and do a sleep for 5 seconds, okay, and then you will do an exit after this 5 seconds have elapsed. Okay, so the child does nothing, it's not doing an exec in this case. All it is doing is it's putting itself to sleep, okay, for 5 seconds, okay, and then it is going to just do an exit. And what the parent does is basically it obtains this process ID, and it can call this kill system call with this option called sick kill, and it can then go and terminate the process. Okay. So if the process is still sleeping, if this kill executes before the sleep has finished and the process has exited, the child has exited by itself, this will cause the child process to be terminated from the outside. Okay. Yes, question here.
Going back to the question a while ago about return values, so when you exit to 0, isn't that a final point of communication with the parent? Isn't it telling the parent that you exit to 0, or is it telling something else that you
exit? So the return value from a program that is finishing is slightly different. What I was talking about is while the processes are executing, there is no communication.
Yeah.
But once the process finishes, it can always get a return value. Yes. To the parent. So in this case, in the previous case, you had a wait system call, right? So the wait system call will always return the status that the child returned. So if you did exit 0, the wait will return an exit 0. I mean the 0. Okay, so that is the return value that came back from the child. That you will get. You had a question?
Yeah. Can the child directly kill a parent, or does the child have to sort of rewire itself to be the parent of that parent?
Yeah. Question is, can the child kill a parent? Yeah, you can. If you have privileges, you can kill any process. There is no relationship that says only parents can kill children or anything like that. You just need to have the right privileges.
Okay.
You can't go and kill someone else's process, okay, because the system will not allow you to do that. If you are a root user, then you can kill any process. You can always terminate your own processes. Okay? Is this clear? Now, you may have done Alt, Escape, Delete or some such thing and say terminate task. So what has happened is that program is actually sending a kill command for that process ID. That's what is happening. Okay, just as, so this is just a trivial use of kill. There are many useful uses where if the program hangs, you have to go and delete it from the outside. That's what you do. Okay, so in this, so you will see that in this activity monitor that I just showed you. Okay, so here is, so you could basically pick any process and then you do quit process. And so you can, in this case, kill yourself. So this will cause you to send a quit or a kill on that process ID. So in this case, you are terminating yourself, which you can also do. It's gone. Right. So you can. That's the way you will basically terminate any process. Okay, including you can always do it to any process ID so long as you have the right privileges. Okay. Yes, question.
If the child process does something completely independent from the parent, I guess I don't understand what the purpose was in copying the code over.
That question, that's a good point. So if the child process was to do something completely different, why did we do this to begin with? That's the way the system calls the design. Yes, if you are designing your own operating system, you could have said, I'm going to do a fork and specify a program name here. So rather than creating a copy of the parent, just load that program and start executing that. That would be a valid system call. That's not the way Unix does it. Okay, but that you could always, so Unix has this two-step process where you create a copy of the parent and then the child basically overrides that copy with something else. You could have had a single call that did the same thing. Okay, there are operating systems that do that. In this case, they have this interface and you are to live with it. But it is some extra wasted work, I agree. But that's the way it works. Okay. So, what I'm going to do is basically just stop here and we'll do a in-class exercise. Okay, just to review what we just talked about. So this I don't have time to finish, so I'm going to wait until next time. So let's just do a quick exercise. So I just want, just to review what we just did, you to just do this exercise. So this is a program, no different from the program that I just showed. So I just want you to look at this program and see what process transition state it goes through. Okay, I showed you these five transition states. I just want you to show the sequence. Okay, I have some sheets if you don't have paper. Okay. Yeah, I'll turn that off. The other thing is I want you to tell me what your group is. Okay, because most of you, or not most, but some of you didn't send it to me. So I need to double check what your groups are. Is that better? Okay, so if you want sheet of paper, it's here. Who wants paper? Okay, it's a very simple program. Okay, I want you to hand this in because I need to know at least what your group is. So don't do it on your own piece of paper. Okay, so just look at this carefully. And be a simple 5-minute exercise.